believe in magic anymore, or things that go bump in the night. For most part, they're happier not knowing.
And when not knowing gets someone killed?
I shrugged. That's where people like me and Murphy come in. Susan eyed me doubtfully. All I need is something solid, Harry. An eyewitness account, a photograph, something.
You can't photograph anything really supernatural, I pointed out. The energies around things like that will mess up cameras. Besides, the stuff I'm dealing with right now is too dangerous. You'd get hurt.
What if I shot from a long way off, she pressed. Used a telephoto lens.
I shook my head. No, Susan, I'm not going to tell you anything. It's for your own good as much as mine.
She pressed her lips together.
Fine, she said, her tone crisp, and went down the stairs. I watched her go, dismayed. It seemed I was making a habit of excluding people from certain brands of information. Not only were my job and my freedom on the line, and Murphy's job, too, now it seemed that my love life, or what passed for it, was in danger as well. I took a moment to try to sort through my thoughts and feelings on Susan, and gave it up as hopeless. Susan was a reporter for the Midwestern Arcane, a tabloid circulated widely from Chicago. It usually ran headlines about Elvis and JFK singing duets in Atlantic City, or on similar topics. But once in a while, Susan managed to slip in something about the real world of the supernatural, the one that people had forgotten about in favor of science. She was damn good at her job, absolutely relentless. She was also charming, gorgeous, funny, and sexy as hell. Our dates had often ended in long, passionate evenings at my place or hers. It was an odd relationship, and neither one of us had tried to define it. I think maybe we were worried that if we did, we would change our minds and write it off as a bad idea. I continued up the stairs, my mind a tired muddle of blood-spattered corpses, savage beasts, angry ex-apprentices, and sultry dark eyes. There were times when my work is hard on my love life. But one thing I'm not is a boring date. The doors to the SI office swung open just before I reached them, and I drew up short. Agent Denton of the FBI was there, tall and immaculate in his gray suit. He stopped, too, and looked at me, holding open the door with one arm. There were bags under his gray eyes, but they were still calculating, assessing, and the veins on his forehead bulged with hypertension. "Mr. Dresden," he said, and nodded to me. "Agent Denton," I replied, keeping my tone polite, even friendly. "Excuse me. I need to get something to Lieutenant Murphy." Denton frowned a little, then glanced at the room behind him, before coming all the way out into the hall and letting the door swing shut. "Maybe now isn't the best time for you to see her, Mr. Dresden." I glanced up at the clock on the wall. It was 5 minutes before 8. "She wanted it early." I stepped to one side to go around him. Denton put a hand on my chest, just that, but he was strong. He might have been shorter than me, but he was carrying a lot more muscle. He didn't look at my eyes, and when he spoke, his voice was very quiet. "Look, Dresden, I know what happened last night didn't look good, but believe me when I say I've got nothing against Lieutenant Murphy. She's a good cop, and she does her job, but she's got to follow the rules, just like everyone else." "I'll keep that in mind," I told him, and started to move again. He kept up the pressure against my chest.
"There's an agent from Internal Affairs in there with her right now. He's already in a bad mood from being hassled by some reporter. Do you really want to go in there and make him start asking all sorts of questions?"
I glanced at him, frowning. He lowered his hand from my chest. I didn't go around him yet.
"You know about the investigation she's under?"
Denton shrugged a shoulder.
"It's to be expected, all things considered. Too much of what has happened in the past looks suspicious."
"You don't really believe, do you?" I asked him. "You don't believe that I'm a real wizard. You don't believe in the supernatural."
Denton straightened his tie.
"What I believe doesn't matter, Mr. Dresden. What is important is that a lot of the scum out there believe in it. It affects the way they think and operate. If I could make use of your advice to solve this case, I would, the same as any other law officer." He glanced at me and added, "Personally, I think you're either slightly unstable or a very intelligent charlatan. No offense."
"None taken," I said,
my voice wry. I nodded to the door. How long will Murphy be busy? Denton shrugged. If you like, I'll take the report in to her, drop it on her desk. You can go down the hall and call her. It doesn't matter to me, but I don't mind helping out a stray cop. I looked over for a second and then passed the folder to him. I appreciate it, Agent Denton. Phil, he said. For a second he almost smiled, but then his face resumed its usual tense expression. Do you mind if I take a look at it? I shook my head. But I hope you like fiction, Phil. He flicked the folder open and studied the first page for a moment, expressionless. He looked up at me. You can't possibly be serious. It was my turn to shrug. Don't knock it. I've helped Murphy out before. He glanced over the rest of the report, the look of skepticism on his face growing more secure. I'll give this to Murphy for you, Mr. Dresden, he said, then nodded to me and turned to walk toward the SI office. Hey, I said casually. Phil? He turned to me and lifted his eyebrows. We're both on the same team here, right? Both of us looking for the killer. He nodded. I nodded back. What is it you're not telling me? He stared at me for a long moment, and then he blinked slowly. The lack of reaction gave him away. I don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Dresden, he said. Sure you do, I told him. You know something you can't or won't tell me, right? So why not just pull it out on the table now? Denton glanced up and down the hall and repeated, in precisely the same tone of voice, I don't know what you're talking about, Mr. Dresden. Do you understand? I didn't understand, but I didn't want him to know that. So I just nodded again. Denton nodded back, turned, and went into the SI office. I frowned, puzzling over Denton's behavior. His expression and reaction had conveyed more than his words, but I wasn't sure exactly what. Except for that one flash of insight the night before, I was having trouble reading him. Some people are just like that. Very good at keeping secrets with their bodies and motions, as well as with their mouths. I shook my head, went to the payphone down the hall, dropped in my quarter, and dialed Murphy's number. Murphy, she said. Denton's dropping off my report. I didn't want to bother you with internal affairs hanging around. There was a note of relief in Murphy's voice, subtle, but there. Thank you. I understand. The investigator is in your office now, isn't he? Right, Murphy said, her tone neutral, polite, professional, and disinterested. Murphy keeps a great poker face when it's necessary, too. If you have any questions, I should be at my office, I said. Hang in there, Murph. We'll nail this guy. There was the sound of a deeper voice, Denton's, and then the slap of a folder hitting the surface of Murphy's desk. Murphy thanked Denton and then spoke to me again. Thank you very much. I'll be right on it. And then she hung up on me. I hung up the phone myself and realized I was vaguely disappointed that I hadn't gotten to really speak to Murphy and that we hadn't had the chance to exchange our usual banter. It bothered me that I couldn't just walk into her office anymore. It made me feel a little queasy and tense inside. I hate politics, but it was there. And as long as I was being held in any amount of suspicion, I could get Murphy in trouble just by being around. Brooding all the while, I stomped down the stairs and out the front door of the station toward the visitor parking where the Blue Beetle waited for me. I had gotten in and was preparing to coax it to life when I heard footsteps. I squinted up into the morning sunshine at the skinny form and big ears of the red-headed young FBI agent from the scene in Rosemont last night. I rolled down the window as he stepped up to my car. He glanced around, his face anxious, then knelt down beside the window so that he could not be easily observed. Hi there, Agent. Harris, he said. Roger Harris. Right, I said. Can I help you, Agent Harris? I need to know, Mr. Dresden. I mean, I wanted to ask you last night, but I couldn't. But I need to ask you now. He glanced around him, restless as a rabbit when a fox goes by, and said, Are you for real? A lot of people ask me that, Agent Harris, I said. I'll tell you what I tell them. Try me and see. He chewed on his lip and looked at me for a minute, then nodded a jerky little nod, his head bobbing. All right, he said. All right. Can I hire you? My eyebrows went up in surprise. Hire me? What for? I think I know something about the Lobo killings. I tried to get Denton to let us check it out, but he said there wasn't enough evidence. We'll never be able to get a surveillance put on them. On who? I asked, wary. The last thing I needed was to be getting involved in any more shady goings-on. On the other hand, as an independent operator, I could sometimes go poking my nose where the police couldn't. If there was a chance I could turn up something for Murphy, or find the killer and stop him outside of legal channels entirely, I couldn't afford to pass it up. There's a gang in Chicago, Harris began. No kidding, I asked, affecting puzzlement. It was lost on the kid. Yeah, they call themselves the Street Wolves. They've got a really rough reputation, even for this town. A spooky reputation. Even the criminals won't go near them. They say the gang has strange powers. Street Wolf territory is down by 49th Street Beach. He stared at me intently. Down by the university, I filled in. And by the parks where last month's murders took place. He nodded, eager as a puppy. Yeah, right, down there. You see what I'm getting at? I see, kid, I see, I told him and rubbed at my eye. Denton wouldn't go there and look around, so he sent you down here to get me to do it. The kid flushed. His skin turned bright red until his freckles vanished. Don't worry about it, I told him. You didn't do a bad job with the act, but you've got to get up pretty early in the morning, etc. Harris chewed on his lip and nodded. Yeah, well, will you do it? I sighed. I guess you can't go on record as paying my fee, can you? It wasn't really a question. Well, no. Officially, you are a suspect source, as a consultant. I nodded. I thought so. Can you do it, Mr. Dresden? Will you? I was regretting it even before I spoke. All right, I said. I'll check it out. But in exchange, tell Denton I want any of the information that the FBI or the Chicago police has on me. Harris paled. You want us to copy your files? Yeah, I said. I could get them through the Freedom of Information Act anyway. I just don't want to spend the time in the postage. Do we have a deal or not? Oh, God, Denton would kill me if he found out. He doesn't like it when someone bends the rules. He chewed on his lip until I thought it would fall off. You mean like he's doing by sending you here to me? I shrugged. Suit yourself, kid. That's my price. You can find my number if you change your mind. I coaxed the beetle to life, and it rattled and coughed and started running. All right, he said. All right, deal. He offered me his hand. I shook it, sealing the bargain, and got an uneasy feeling as I did. Harris walked away from the beetle as quickly as he could, still looking around nervously. That was stupid, Harry, I told myself. You shouldn't be getting yourself into anything more complicated than you already have. I was right. But potential gains made the risk worth it. I could possibly find the killers, stop them, and additionally find out why the cops had to bug up their collective asses about me. It might help me work things out with Murphy. It might even help me get her out of the trouble she was having. Cheer up, Harry, I told myself. I'm just gonna go poke around a biker's lair. Ask them if they happen to have killed some people lately. What could possibly go wrong? Chapter 9. A block from the 49th Street beach, there was a rundown garage, the sort of place you only find in the worst section of big cities. The building consisted of corrugated metal on a steel frame, oxidizing in the rain and the mist rising off the lake, so that gobbets of rust ran down the walls in streaks and pooled on the sidewalks in uneven puddles. One side of the garage was a vacant lot. The other, what looked like sort of a pawn shop, where crooks traded in their spare guns and knives for a few extra dollars when things got tight. A faded sign hung askew over one of the garage doors, reading, Full Moon Garage. I pulled the beetle into the gravel parking lot and parked a few feet from the building. Thank God it's not too obvious or anything, I muttered, and killed the engine. It died, with a new moaning note to its usual rattle. I got out of the car, squinted at the building, and toward it. I didn't have my gun with me, but I did have my blasting rod, my shield bracelet, and a ring on my right hand in which I had stored up about as much energy as someone twice my size could put into a solid punch. Gravel crunched under my shoes as I walked, and a rare autumn sunshine glared in my eyes and cast a long shadow behind me. I wasn't sure who to expect inside, if anyone. The people I'd seen with the dark-haired woman the night before, the rather nerdy bunch of young people clad in imitation biker leathers, didn't seem to be the sort of people to inspire fear in other criminal toughs, as the street wolves apparently had. Maybe there was a connection. Maybe the dark-haired woman from the last night was linked with the street wolves, somehow, as well as with the young people I'd seen. What had the stout young man Billy called them? The alphas. What then had the alphas been? Biker thugs in training? That sounded ridiculous, even to me. But what if those young people had been lycanthropes, like the ones Bob had told me about? What if they were being trained, somehow, as junior members of the street wolves until they could be brought in as full werewolves? Presuming the street wolves themselves were lycanthropes, or werewolves, that is. Sometimes a biker gang is just a biker gang. There might be no connection to the alphas at all. My head spun a little, trying to sort out the possibilities. All in all, it was far better to hope that the building was empty and that I wouldn't have to deal with anyone, werewolves or otherwise. I would much rather just poke around and find something incriminating inside, something I could bring back to Murphy and Denton that would point them in the correct direction. There was a regular door beside the pair of big, rolled-up garage doors. Both of them were closed. I tried the regular door, and it opened easily enough, so I went inside. There were no windows, and the only light in the garage fell onto it from an open door behind me. "Hello?" I called into the darkness. I tried to peer around, but saw nothing other than the dim shapes and outlines, what might have been a car with the hood up, a couple of those rolling tool cabinets. There was a dull reflection of glass windows off to one side, where there might have been an office. I stepped to one side of the doorway, squinting, and waited for my eyes to adjust. There was a quiet sound, a dull rustle of clothing. Damn it. I reached a hand in my duster, wrapped my fingers around my blasting rod, and listened. I could hear the sound of breathing in the room, from multiple sources in a variety of directions. There was a scuffling sound, shoes on concrete floor. "I'm not a cop," I said into the darkness. I had a feeling that might be important for them to know. "My name is Harry Dresden. I just want to speak to the street wolves." The room dropped into dead silence. No moving, no breathing, nothing. I waited, tense and ready to run. "Take your hand out of your jacket," a male voice said, "and keep your hands where I can see them. We've heard of your kind, wizard. We've heard of you. You're with the cops." "You're late on the gossip," I said, wryly. "I'm playing doubles with Johnny Marconi now. Didn't you know?" There was a snort from the dark. "Like hell. That's just Marconi's story. We know the real deal with you, wizard." Christ. I wish the police were as savvy as these ne'er-do-wells. "I've heard a few things about you all, too," I said. "Not much of it's too friendly. Some of it might be considered a little weird." There was a rough laugh. "What do you think they say about you, Dresden? Get your hands where I can see them, now." There was the click-clack of a pump shotgun's action. I swallowed and took my hands slowly off my blasting rod, then held up both my hands innocuously out in front of me, palms up. I willed strength through my shield bracelet as I did, drawing its protective energies about me. "All right," I said. "Come up here where I can see you." "You don't give the orders here," the male voice snarled. "I do." I pressed my lips together and drew in a breath through my nose. "I just want to talk to you." "About what?" said the voice. I tried to come up with something believable, but I'm not much of a liar. So I told him the truth. "Some dead people last month. More died last night." The voice didn't answer me for a moment. I licked my lips and kept going. "There were fake wolf tracks around the murder scenes, and the feds think someone used a weapon lined with wolf teeth to tear the victims up. You wouldn't know anything about that, would you?" There was a flurry of mutters around the room. Low voices and hushed tones all around me. A dozen, maybe. More. I got a sudden sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. If these people were the murderers, if they were responsible for last month's deaths, I was in big trouble. And if they were real werewolves, if they could shapeshift and come after me before I could clear out, I was as good as dead, shield bracelet or no. I choked down a surge of panic and forced myself not to turn and run for the door. "Kill him," someone said from the darkness, off to my left. A female voice with a deep, growling tone to it. There was an answering chorus of mewing sounds from the dark around me, repetitions of, "Kill him! Kill him! Kill him!" My eyes started to adjust to the lack of light. I could see them now. The shapes of people, restlessly pacing. Their eyes glowed like dog's eyes in the glare of headlights. Both men and women moved around me, but I couldn't tell their ages. There were blankets and pillows made into pallets on the floor, thrown aside when their occupants had risen. The female voice I had heard was continuing to chant, "Kill him! Kill him! Kill him!" while the others followed her lead. The air grew tight and heavy with a kind of energy I had never sensed before, a power that was gaining momentum as they chanted, a feral, raging current. Directly in front of me, not 15 feet away, stood the large shape of a man holding a shotgun. "Stop it," he snarled, turning his head toward the others in the room. I could see his body responding as the energy grew, growing tenser, more ready. "Fight it. Hold it in, damn it. You can't let it loose here. There'll be cops all over us." When his head turned, I darted for the doorway. I kept my left palm up and turned out toward the leader, the one with the shotgun, and held onto my shield as hard as I could. My motion triggered a frenzied howl from the others in the room, and they came surging toward me like a dozen creatures with one controlling mind. The shotgun roared and threw a flash of white light over the room, showing me a frieze of half-dressed or naked men and women hurtling towards me, their faces twisted with grimaces of berserk anger. The force of the blast slammed into my shield. It wasn't quite enough to shatter the protective shield, but it made my bracelet grow warm and shoved my opposite shoulder hard against the wall. I stumbled, thrown off balance. One of the men, a heavy-set fellow with his shoulders covered in tattoos, got between me and the door. I ran at him. He spread his arms to grab me, assuming I would try to get past him. Instead, I drove my fist at his nose as hard as I could. I don't carry a lot of power on my own when I punch, but when I added the kinetic energy stored in the ring, my fist became a battering ram of bone and flesh, flattening the man's nose in a gout of blood and sending him sprawling to the ground 6 feet away. I was through the door in a flash and felt the sun's warm heat on my back. I pelted toward the beetle, my long legs covering the ground quickly. "Stop! Stop!" the leader shouted. And I cast a glance over my shoulder to see him, an older man with greasy hair beginning to go gray. He planted his feet in the doorway, facing inside, held the shotgun across his body, and shoved the people trying to get past him. I threw myself into the beetle and jammed the key into the ignition. The car wheezed and rattled, but didn't start. Damn it. My hands were trembling, but I kept trying to get the car going, using every trick I knew to coax the engine to life while watching the door. The leader of the street wolves was still there, fighting to hold the frenzied group inside. They were screaming and howling, but he shoved them away, clubbed them down with a shotgun like wild dogs, the muscles in his shoulders and back straining. "Parker!" screamed one of them, the woman who had begun the killing chant. "Let me through!" He swatted her down with the butt of the shotgun without hesitation. Then Parker turned his head toward me, and I met his eyes. There was a swimming moment, and then I was past his eyes to what lay behind them. Fury overwhelmed me. Naked lust for meat, for the hunt. I needed to run, to kill. I was invincible, unstoppable. I could feel the power in my arms and hands, feel the raw energy of the wild coursing through me, sharpening my senses to animal keenness. I felt his emotions like they were my own. Fury behind rigid control, the ocean beating at a tide wall. The fury was directed at me, Dresden, at the man who had invaded his territory, challenged his authority, and driven his people out of control, endangering them. I saw that he was the leader of the lycanthropes called the Street Wolves, men with the minds and souls of beasts, and that he was aging, not as strong as he once had been. Others, like the woman earlier, were beginning to challenge his authority. Today's events might tear him from leadership, and he would never live through it. If Parker was to live, I had to die. He had to kill me, pure and simple, and he had to do it alone, to prove his strength to the pack. That was the only thing that kept him from coming at my throat that very second. Worse, he didn't know a damn thing about last month's killings. And then the moment was past, the soul gaze over. Parker's face was stunned. He had seen me in much the same way I had seen him. I didn't know what he saw when he looked upon my soul. I didn't want to know what was down there. I recovered from it before he did and fumbled at the keys again. The beetle coughed to life and I pulled out and onto the street, swerving wildly before gathering speed and heading back uptown as quickly as I could. I shook the entire way. My shoulders so tight with fear and reaction that I could hear my collarbones creaking with strain. I could still hear the mewling chants of kill him, in my head. Those things in that garage had not been people. They had looked like people, but they weren't. They scared the hell out of me. While sitting in an intersection, I slammed my hand on the steering wheel, abruptly angry. "Stupid Harry," I said. "How could you have been so stupid? Why in the hell did you go wandering in like that? Do you recognize how close those Neanderthal freaks came to tearing you apart?" I glared ferociously out my side window at an old lady in a business suit who was staring at me as though I were a ranting madman, which, I suppose, was what I looked like. I stopped myself from glaring at her, took a deep breath, and tried to calm down. A couple of blocks later, I was able to start thinking straight again. Parker and the Street Wolves were not responsible for the murders last month. That didn't make them any less dangerous. They were lycanthropes, the kind Bob had told me about, and I could see now why they had been feared. People with the souls of beasts, possessed of a ferocity so great that it could transform them into something inhuman without altering a single cell of their bodies. They lived in a pack, and Parker was their leader. I had challenged his dominance in my clueless, bumbling way, and now he couldn't afford to let me live, or he'd be killed himself. So now I had to worry about someone else coming after me, trying to kill me. Not only that, all of this trouble had come gratis, without giving me any lead on the true culprit of the Lobo killings. Maybe it was a good time to leave town for a while. I brooded over that for a block or so, then shook my head. I wouldn't run. I had made this trouble for myself, and I could get out of it myself. I had to stay, to help Murphy find the killer, to help save lives before the full moon rose again. And if Parker wanted to kill me, well, he'd find out that doing in a full-fledged wizard was no easy task. I gripped the steering wheel grimly. If it came to it, I would kill him. I knew I could do that. Technically, I suppose, Parker and his lycanthropes weren't human. The first law of magic, thou shalt not kill, wouldn't necessarily apply to them. Legally, I might be able to make a case for the use of lethal magic to the White Council. I just wouldn't be safe for myself. I wouldn't be safe from the loathing I would feel, using a tool made of life's essence, its energy, to bring an end to life. Magic was more than just an energy source, like electricity or petroleum. It was a power, true, but it was a lot of other things as well. It was all that was deepest and most powerful in nature, in the human heart and soul. The ways in which I had applied it were crude and clumsy in comparison to the magic in its pure form. There's more magic in a baby's first giggle than in any firestorm a wizard can conjure up, and don't anyone tell you any different. Magic comes from what's inside you. It's part of you. You can't weave together a spell that you don't believe in. I didn't want to believe that killing was deep inside of me. I didn't want to think about the part of me that took dark joy in gathering all the power it could and using it as I saw fit, everything else be damned. There was power to be had in hatred, too, in anger, and in lust, in selfishness, and in pride. I knew that there was some dark corner of me that would enjoy using magic for killing, and then long for more. That was black magic, and it was too easy to use. Easy and fun, like Legos. I parked the Beetle in the lot of my office building and rubbed my eyes. I didn't want to kill anybody, but Parker and his gang might not give me any choice. I might have to do a lot of killing if I was going to live. I tried not to think too much about what sort of person it might be who survived. I would burn that bridge when I came to it. I would go up to my office and hold business hours for the rest of the day. I would wait for Murphy to call me and give her any aid I could. I would keep my eyes and ears open in case Parker or any of his gang came after me. There wasn't much more I could do. It was frustrating as hell. I went up to my office, unlocked it, and flipped on the lights. Gentleman Johnny Marconi was seated at my desk in a dark blue business suit, and his hulking bodyguard, Mr. Hendricks, was standing behind him. Marconi smiled at me, but it didn't touch the corner of his eyes. "Ah, yes, Mr. Dresden. Good. We need to talk." Chapter 10. Marconi had eyes the color of old, faded dollar bills. His skin was weather-worn, with an outdoorsman's deep tan. Creases showed in the corner of his eyes and mouth, as though from smiling, but those smiles were rarely sincere. His suit must have cost him at least $1,000. He sat at ease in my chair, mind you, and regarded me with a professional calm. From behind him, Mr. Hendricks looked like an all-star collegiate lineman who hadn't been smart enough to go into the pros. Hendricks' neck was as big around as my waist, and his hands were big enough to cover my face, and strong enough to crush it. His red hair was a buzz cut, and he wore his ill-fitting suit like something that he had planned to rip his way out of when he turned into the Hulk. I couldn't see his gun, but I knew he was carrying one. I stood in the doorway and stared at Marconi for a minute, but my gaze did nothing to stir him. Marconi had met it already, and taken my measure more than I had taken his. My eyes held no more fear for him. "Get out of my office," I said. I came in and closed the door. Now, Mr. Dresden," Marconi said, a father's reproof in his tone. "Is that any way to talk to a business partner?" I scowled. "I'm not your partner. I think you're scum. The worst criminal this city has. One of these days, the cops will nail you, but until then, I don't have to put up with you being here in my office. Get out." "The police," Marconi said, a hint of correction in his voice, "would be best off run by private agencies rather than public institutions. Better pay, better benefits." "Easier to bribe, corrupt, manipulate," I injected. Marconi smiled. I took off my duster and dropped it over the table in front of the door, the one covered in pamphlets with titles like "Witches and You" and "Want to Do Magic? Ask Me How." I untied my blasting rod from its thong and set it calmly on the table in front of me. I had the satisfaction of seeing Hendricks tense up when he saw the rod. He remembered what I had done to the varsity last spring. I glanced up. "Are you still here?" Marconi folded his arms in front of him. "I have an offer to make you, Mr. Dresden." "No," I said. Marconi chuckled. "I think you should hear me out." I looked him in the eyes and smiled faintly. "No, get out." His fatherly manner vanished and his eyes became cold. "I have neither the time nor the tolerance for your childishness, Mr. Dresden. People are dying. You are now working on the case. I have information for you, and I want to give it to you for a price." I felt my back stiffen. I stared at him for a long minute and then said, "All right, let's hear your price." Marconi held out his hand and Hendricks handed him a folder. Marconi put the folder down on the battered surface of my old wooden desk and flipped it open. "This is a contract, Mr. Dresden. It hires you as a consultant for my firm in personal security. The terms are quite generous. You get to name your own hours with a minimum of 5 per month. You can fill in your salary right now. I simply want to formalize our working relationship. I walked over to my desk. I saw Hendricks wait shift as though he were about to jump over the desk at me, but I ignored him. I picked up the folder and looked over the contract. I'm not a legal expert, but I was familiar with the forms for this kind of deal. Marconi was on the up and up. He was offering me a dream job with virtually no commitment and as much money as I could want. There was even a clause in it that specified that I would not be asked or expected to perform any unlawful acts. With that kind of money, I could live the kind of life I wanted. Could stop scraping for every dollar, running my legs off working for every paranoid loony who wanted to hire me to investigate his great-aunt's possessed cow. I could catch up on reading, finally. Do the magical research I've been itching to do for the past few years. I couldn't live forever, and every hour that I wasted looking for UFOs in Joliet was one more hour I could spend doing something I wanted to do. It was a pretty damn tempting deal. It was a very comfortable collar. "Do you think I'm an idiot?" I said, and tossed the folder down on my desk. Marconi's eyebrows went up, his mouth opening a little. "Is it the hours? Shall I lower the minimum to 1 hour per week, per month?" "It isn't the hours," I said. He spread his hands. "What, then?" "It's the company. It's the thought of a drug-dealing murderer having a claim on my loyalty. I don't like where your money comes from. It's got blood on it." Marconi's cold eyes narrowed again. "Think carefully, Mr. Dresden. I don't make this offer twice." "Let me make you an offer, John," I said. I saw the corner of his cheek twitched when I used his first name. "Tell me what you know, and I'll do my best to nail the killer before he comes for you." "What makes you think I'm worried, Mr. Dresden?" Marconi said. He let a fine sneer color his words. I shrugged. "Your business partner and his pet bodyguard gets gutted last month. Spike gets torn into bits last night. And then you crawl out from under your rock to dangle information in my face to help me catch the killer and try to strong-arm me into becoming your bodyguard." I bent down and rested my elbows on the surface of the desk, then lowered my head until my eyes were a few inches from his. "Worried, John?" His face twitched again, and I could smell him lying. "Of course not, Mr. Dresden. But I didn't get where I have in life by being reckless. Just by being soulless, right?" Marconi slammed his palms down at the desktop and stood. I rose with him, enough to stand over him and keep my eyes on his. "I am a man of business, Mr. Dresden. Would you prefer anarchy in the streets? Wars between rival crime lords? I bring order to that chaos." "No, you just make the chaos more efficient and organized," I shot back. "Stick whatever pretty words you want onto it, but it doesn't change the fact that you're a thug. A fucking animal that should be caged, nothing more." Marconi's normally passionless face went white. His jaw clenched over words of rage. I pressed him hard, my own anger spilling with a passion gone out of control. I poured all of my recent frustration and fear into venomous words and hurled them like a handful of scrap metal. "What is that out there, John? What could it possibly be? Did you see Spike? Did you see how they'd torn his face off? Did you see the way they'd ripped his guts open? I did. I could smell what he had for dinner. Can you just imagine it happening to you next, John?" "Don't call me that," Marconi said. His voice was so quiet and cold that it sent my momentum back on its heels. "If we were in public, Mr. Dresden, I'd have you killed for speaking to me that way." "If we were in public," I told him, "you'd try." I drew myself up and glared down my nose at him, ignoring Hendrick's looming presence. "Now, get the hell out of my office." Marconi straightened his jacket and his tie. "I presume, Mr. Dresden, that you are going to continue your investigation with the police department?" "Of course." Marconi walked around my desk past me and toward my door. Hendricks followed in his wake, huge and quiet.
Then in my own interests, I must accept your offer and aid the investigation however I might. Look up the name Harley McFinn. Ask about the Northwest Passage Project. See where they lead. He opened the door.
Why should I believe you?
I asked him. He looked back at me. You have seen the deepest reaches of my soul, Mr. Dresden. You know me in a way so profound and intimate that I cannot yet fathom its significance. Just as I know you. You should know that I have every reason to help you, and that the information is good. He smiled again, wintry. Just as you should know that it is unwise to make an enemy out of me. It need not have been this way. I narrowed my eyes. If you know me so well, you should know that there is no other way it could be. He pursed his lips for a moment and did not try to refute me.
Pity, he said. A true pity. And then he left.
Hendricks gave me a pig-eyed little glare, then he was gone too. The door shut behind them. I let out a long, shaking breath and slumped into my desk. Covered my face with my hands, noticing as I did that they were shaking too. I hadn't realized the depth of the disgust in me for Marconi and what he stood for. I hadn't realized how much it had sickened me to have my name associated with his. I hadn't realized how much I wanted to launch myself at the man and smash him in the nose with my fists. I stayed that way for several minutes, letting my heart beat hard, catching my breath. Marconi could have killed me. He could have had Hendricks tear me apart, or put a bullet in me right there. But he hadn't. That wasn't Marconi's way. He couldn't eliminate me now. Not after working so hard to spread the word throughout the underworld that he and I had some sort of alliance. He would have to be more indirect, more subtle. Having Hendricks scatter my brains out on the floor wasn't the way to do it. I thought over what he had said, and the implications of his acceptance of the deal I'd offered. He was in danger. Something had him scared. Something that he didn't understand or didn't know how to fight. That was why he wanted to hire me. As a wizard, I take the unknown and turn it into something that can be measured. I take that cloak of terror off of things and make people able somehow to deal with them. Marconi wanted me to stand by him, to help him not be afraid of those things lurking in the dark. Hell, he was only human. I winced. I wanted to hate the man, but disgust, maybe anger, was as far as I could go. Too much of what he said was true. Marconi was a businessman. He had reduced violence in the streets, while sending the number of dollars made by criminals in this town soaring. He had protected the city's flesh while siphoning away its blood, poisoning its soul. It changed nothing, nothing at all. But to know that the man I knew, the tiger-souled predator, the businessman killer, to know that he was frightened of what I was about to go up against, that scared the hell out of me, and added an element of intimidation to the work I was doing that hadn't been present before. That didn't change anything either. It's all right to be afraid. You just don't let it stop you from doing your job. I sat down on the desk, forced the thoughts of blood and fangs and agonizing death from my mind, and started looking for the name Harley McFinn and the Northwest Passage Project. Chapter 11. The demon, trapped in the summoning circle, screamed, slamming its crab-like pincers against the unseen barrier, hurling its chitinous shoulders from side to side in an effort to escape the confinement. It couldn't. I kept my will on the circle, kept the demon from being able to burst free. "Satisfied, Chauncey?" I asked it. The demon straightened its hideous form and said, in a perfect Oxford accent,
"Quite. You understand, I must observe formalities."
Then it took a pair of wholly incongruous wire-frame spectacles from beneath a scale and perched them upon the beak-like extremity of its nose.
"You have questions?"
I let out a sigh of relief and sat down on the edge of the work table in my lab. I had cleared away all the clutter from around the summoning ring in the floor, and I'd have to move it before I could clamber out of my lab, but I didn't like to take chances.
No matter how comfortable Sean Zagaroth and I were with our working relationship, there was always a chance I could have messed up the summoning. There were rules of protocol that demonic beings were obliged to follow. One of them was offering resistance to any mortal wizard who'd called them. Another was doing their best to end the life of the same wizard, should they be able to escape the confines of the circle. All in all, squeezing information from fairies and spirits of the elements was a lot easier and safer. But Bob had turned up nothing in his search among the local spirits. They weren't always up on information to be had in the city, and Bob now resided in his skull again, exhausted and unable to help any further. So I'd gone to the underworld for assistance. They know when you've been bad or good, and they make Santa Claus look like an amateur. I need information about a man named Harley MacFinn, Chauncey, and about something he was working on called the Northwest Passage Project. Chauncey clacked his pinchers pensively.
I see. Presuming I have this information, what is it worth to you?
Not my soul, I snorted. Don't even start with that. Look, I could dig this up myself in a few days. Chauncey tilted his head, bird-like.
Ah, but time is of the essence, yes?
Come now, Harry Dresden. You do not call upon me lightly. The possible dangers, both from myself and from your own white council, are far too great.
I scowled at him. Technically, I said, I'm not breaking any of the laws of magic. I'm not robbing you of your will, so I'm clear on the fifth law. And the need for this calling is perfectly legitimate, so I'm clear of the fourth law. The council can bite me. The bone ridges above Chauncey's eyes twitched. Surely that is merely a colorful euphemism rather than a statement of desire. It is. Chauncey pushed the glasses a bit higher up on his nose.
The moral and ethical ramifications of your attitudes are quite fascinating, Harry Dresden. I am continually amazed that you remain in the council's good graces, knowing full well that most of the council would look the other way while their enforcers killed you, should they learn that you have willfully brought a demon into this world. You still summon me not once, but half a dozen times. Your attitudes are much more contiguous with those of many of my brethren in the world below.
And I should throw in with your side, accept the dark powers, etc., etc.? I finished for him with a sigh. Hell's bells, Chauncey. Why do you keep on trying to sucker me into signing with the down below, huh? Chauncey shrugged his bulky shoulders.
I admit it would give me no small amount of status to gather a soul of your caliber into our legions, he said. Additionally, it would free me from the onerous duties that make even these excruciating visits to your world seem pleasant by comparison.
Well, you aren't getting my soul today, I told him, so make me a counteroffer, or we can call a close to this negotiations and I can send you back. The demon shuddered.
Yes, very well. Let's not be hasty, Mr. Dresden. I have the information you need. Additionally, I have more information of which you are not aware, and which would be of great interest to you, and which, I judge additionally, may help to preserve your life and the lives of others. Given the situation, I do not think the price I will ask inappropriate. I wish another of your names.
I frowned. The demon had two of my names already. If he gained my whole name from my own lips, he could use it in any number of magical applications against me. That didn't particularly disturb me. Demons and their ilk had great difficulty in reaching out from the never-never, the spirit world beyond the physical one we inhabit, with sorcery. But Sean Zagaroth was a popular source of information among wizards who went to the underworld in need of it. What bothered me was the possibility that one of them would get it. Chauncey was correct. There were a lot of people on the White Council who would be happy to see me dead. If one of them got my name, there was a chance they would use it against me, either to kill me or to magically force me to do something that would openly violate one of the seven laws and have me brought to trial and killed. On the other hand, Chauncey never lied to me. If he said he had information that could save people's lives, he had it, and that's all there was to it. Hell, he might even know who the killer was, though a demon's grasp of individual human identity could be somewhat shaky. I decided to gamble. Done, I said. All pertinent information on the subject of my inquiry in exchange for another of my names. Chauncey nodded once.
Agreed.
All right, I said. Let's have the information on McFinn and the Northwest Passage Project.
Very well, Chauncey said. Harley McFinn is an heir to a considerable fortune made in coal mining and railroads at the turn of the 20th century. He is one of the 10 richest men in the country known as the United States. He served during the police action in Vietnam, and when he returned to this country, he began divesting himself of business interests, merely accruing capital. His favorite color is red. His shoe size...
We can skip the little details unless you think they'll be really relevant, I said. I could hear about his favorite food and his problems in middle school all day, but it wouldn't help anything. I got out my notebook and started taking notes.
As you wish, Chauncey assented. The object of his endeavors for the past several years has been the Northwest Passage Project. The project is an effort to buy enormous tracts of land, beginning in the central Rocky Mountains of the American Southwest, and moving northwest into Canada, to provide for an enormous migratory-sized preserve for North American wildlife.
He wants to make his own private playground out of the Rocky Mountains, I blurted.
No, Harry Dresden. He wishes to acquire the lands that are not already owned by the government, then donate them, provided the government guarantees that they will be used as a part of the Northwest Passage Project.
He has considerable backing from the environmentalist groups throughout the country, and support in your capital, as well, provided he can get the land.
Wow, I said, impressed.
You said he has a lot of support. Who wants to stop him?
Industrial interests still looking to expand into the Northwest, Chauncey said.
Let me guess. James Harding III was one of them, I said, already writing it down.
How did you know?
Chauncey asked. He was killed by a werewolf last month along with his bodyguard. Several other people died as well.
Chauncey beamed. You are a clever man, Harry Dresden.
Yes. James Douglas Harding III was exceptionally interested in blocking McFinn's efforts to acquire property. He came to Chicago to have negotiations with McFinn, but died before they were complete. I closed my eyes for a minute, thinking.
Okay. Harding comes to town to talk with McFinn. Harding's in cahoots with Marconi, so maybe Marconi is hosting the talks. Harding and his bodyguard get et al. Up by a werewolf, so... McFinn's the werewolf in question?
Chauncey smiled. A rather intimidating expression.
McFinn is a member of an ancient family line from an island known as Ireland. His family has a notable history. Sometime in the murky past, legend would have it, a man known as St. Patrick cursed his ancestor to become a ravening beast at every full moon. The curse came with two addenda. First, that it would be hereditary, passing down to someone new each and every generation. And second, that the cursed line of the family would never, ever die out, lasting until the end of days.
I wrote that down as well and snorted.
A Catholic saint did that?
Chauncey made a sound of distaste.
I am not responsible for the sorts of people the other side employs, wizard, or the tactics they use.
Considering the source, I think I'll note it as a biased opinion. Your folk have done a thousand times worse, I said.
Well, true, Chauncey admitted. But we tend to be quite honest about the sort of beings we are and the sort of things we stand for, at least.
I snorted. All right. This is making a lot more sense now. McFinn is a Loup Garou, one of the legendary monsters. He's trying to do some good in his spare time, make a big park for all furry critters, but Harding puts himself in the way. McFinn goes on a killing spree and wipes him out. I frowned. Except that Harding was the last person to be murdered last month. You would have thought that if McFinn was going to lose it, that he would have been the first to go. I peered at Chauncey. Is McFinn the murderer?
McFinn is a murderer, Chauncey said. But among humankind he is one of many, and not the most monstrous.
Is he the one who killed Marconi's bodyguard, the people last month?
My information on that point is inconclusive, Harry Dresden, Chauncey said. His black eyes gleamed. Perhaps for the price of another name, I could inquire of my brethren and give you a more precise answer.
I scowled. Not a chance. Do you know who murdered the other people last month?
I do, Chauncey said. Murder is one of the foremost sins, and we keep close track of sins.
I leaned forward intently. Who was it? Chauncey laughed, a grating sound.
Really, Harry Dresden, in the first place our bargain was for information regarding McFinn and the Northwest Passage Project. In the second, I would not tell you the answer to such a direct question, and you know it. There is a limit on how much I may involve myself in mortal affairs.
I let out a breath of frustration and rubbed my eyes. Yeah, yeah, all right, Chauncey. What else can you tell me?
Only that Harley McFinn was planning to meet with Johnny Marconi tomorrow night and continue the talks.
Wait a minute. Is Marconi the major opponent to the project now?
Correct, Chauncey said. He assumed control of a majority of the business interest shared with Harding upon Harding's death.
So, Marconi had a fantastic motive to have Harding killed. It broadened his financial empire and put him into a position to gouge McFinn for as much money as he possibly could. Chauncey adjusted his wire-framed spectacles.
Your reasoning would seem sound.
I thumped my pencil on my notebook, staring at what I had written. Yeah, but it doesn't explain why everyone else got killed, or who did it. Unless Marconi's got a pack of werewolves in his pocket, that is. I chewed on my lip and thought about my encounter at the Full Moon Garage. Or street wolves.
Is there anything else? Chauncey asked, his manner solicitous.
Yes, I said. Where can I find McFinn?
888 Ralston Place.
I wrote it down. But that's right here in Chicago, in the Gold Coast.
Where do you expect a billionaire to live when he was in Chicago, Harry Dresden? Now, I seem to have lived up to all of my obligations. I expect my payment now.
Chauncey took a few restless steps back and forth within the circle. His time on Earth was beginning to wear on him. I nodded. My name, I said, is Harry Blackstone Dresden. I carefully omitted Copperfield from the words, while leaving the tones and pronunciation the same.
Harry Blackstone Dresden. Chauncey repeated carefully. Harry, as in Harry Houdini? Blackstone, the stage illusionist?
I nodded. My dad was a stage magician. When I was born, he gave me those names. They were always his heroes. I think if my mother had survived the birth, she would have slapped him for it. I made a few more notes on my page, getting ideas down on paper before they fled from memory.
Indeed, Chauncey agreed. Your mother was a most direct and willful woman. Her loss was a great sadness to all of us.
I blinked, startled, and the pencil fell from my fingers. I stared at the demon for a moment. You knew my mother? You knew Margaret Gwendolyn Dresden? Chauncey regarded me without expression or emotion.
Many in the underworld were familiar with her. Harry Blackstone Dresden, though under a different name. Her coming was awaited with great anticipation, but the Dark Prince lost her in the end.
What do you mean? What are you talking about? Chauncey's eyes gleamed with avarice.
Didn't you know about your mother's past, Mr. Dresden? A pity we didn't have this conversation sooner. You might have added it up into the bargain we made. Of course, if you would like to forfeit another name to know all about your mother's past, his voice twisted with distaste, redemption, and the unnatural deaths of both mother and father, I am certain we can work something out.
I gritted my teeth in a sudden rush of childlike frustration. My heart pounded in my ears. My mother's dark past? I had expected she was a wizardress, but I had never been able to prove anything, one way or another. Unnatural deaths?